Hi, this is Joe Mama. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's edition, host Elisa Breitenbach talks with former attorney and author Barry Goldstein about why mothers that are victims of domestic violence are losing custody of their children to their abuser. Then, in the second half, host Rebecca Hamilton talks with Judge Artie Bland about why the KCMO Municipal Court feels Senate Bill 572, meant to correct unjust revenue-generating municipal court practices in Ferguson and St. Louis, would endanger public safety in Kansas City. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Coming up next is Elisa and her guest.
Good morning, everyone. This is Elisa Breitenbach, and I'm honored to be here with our guest, Barry Goldstein. Please get out your pens and paper because you will want it for this show. Today, we're going to talk about Barry Goldstein's new book, The Quincy Solution, that shows how we can drastically reduce domestic violence crime with proven practices and save $500 billion in the United States each year. Barry Goldstein is a nationally recognized domestic violence expert, speaker, writer, and consultant, a.k.a. hero for children and mothers of domestic violence. Good morning, Barry. Let's talk about your book and how the story came about with your background.
Okay, good morning, Elisa. Nice to be with you.
Thank you for being here. It's unacceptable to think that 1 billion women, that is actually four women, one in four, that are affected by violence at some point in their life. Violence against women is devastating, and it not only affects the victims, but everyone around them. It destroys and impoverishes families and impacts communities at large. Could you talk about your book, Barry, and the research that it shows and how it proves all of this?
Yes, I took a look at the practices in Quincy, Massachusetts, that used some of the best practices to dramatically reduce domestic violence. And the district attorney, Bill Delahunt, noticed that virtually every prisoner at a nearby high-security jail had a childhood history that included domestic violence and often child sexual abuse. And he thought that if he could prevent domestic violence, it would reduce all crimes, and that's exactly what happened. A county that had been averaging five or six domestic violence homicides enjoyed several years with no murders, and then there was one, and then there were none for a few more years. So we know practices that will work. Similar practices in places like San Diego and Nashville had similar great success. And in some ways, it's just common sense, except that most of our officials have not used these practices since then. Basically, it's strict enforcement of criminal laws, orders of protection, probation rules, practices that make it easier for victims to leave their abuser, and a coordinated community response. And in looking at it, I updated it with new technology, new research, and we have to include the custody court system. The prosecutor noticed that the victims would stop cooperating when the abuser sought custody, and that didn't derail the success in Quincy, because at the time that was a rare tactic. But today, as you know, it's a standard abuser tactic to go after custody to regain control over their victims. And the courts, you know, are stuck in practices from the 1970s, and so they are very easily manipulated.
I venture to say that if women that are in domestic violence situations, if they could read the research, they would put their tennis shoes on and track shoes and run as fast as they could. The research for the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention found that children exposed to domestic violence and child abuse live shorter lives and suffer more injuries and illnesses as children and later as adults. And it demonstrates the consequences that the exposure of domestic violence, what it does to a child. And the Department of Justice studied has established that these flawed practices lead to decisions that really hurt children in courtrooms. One of the things that I found amazing is the outdated custody practices that literally kill children. Courts need to follow and accept the very best practices that keep children and families safe. Our children deserve practices that are evidence-based and multidisciplinary and trauma-informed. And Barry, you're really the first one that brought all this to my attention. And if all women knew this and we were educated on this, I don't think that there would be so many battered women.
Well, I mean, I don't want to put the blame on the women, because we need to remember that abusers don't show their behavior at first. If the abusers were abusive 24/7, or if they were abusive at the start of the relationship, there would be no relationship.
I agree.
As we know, abusers are very manipulative, so they will start out treating their partners really well, and it's only later, when they have much more control, that they start engaging in these practices. So what we really want to do is focus on the abuser and focus on the community to make it stop, rather than on the women.
But the sad thing is, like the picture on the front of your book, it's got a man stepping on a rose, which is so typical of what women who are in these situations are in. These men give us roses. We believe it will never happen again, but the pattern keeps happening. And until we understand what is going on and we understand those patterns, I have no faith in the system. I have faith in people like you that can bring this information to light. The courts often use unqualified professionals to train other court professionals, which makes it almost impossible for courts to get any of our cases right. With all the misinformation that they're using, and custody courts just have not developed any fundamental reforms in response to your research and providing many common practices and beliefs that are placing kids in total jeopardy.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to think that the picture on the cover of my book shows a man starting to step on the rose, and that if we implement the Quincy solution, we can still save the rose and, of course,
the family,
women and children.
Yes.
And, you know, the thing that I think is different is the money. You know, we've always thought that you have to spend money to prevent domestic violence, which to some extent you do, but that, you know, what you're doing is balancing the cost with the benefits. But what my research found is that rather than spending money being a cost, the money is going to come back, you know, multiple times, so that the Quincy solution, if it were implemented nationally, would save the United States $500 billion a year. And that's a substantial sum.
It's huge.
And it ought to provide the incentive for public officials to adopt these practices, even if they're not going to do it because battered women are not the most important thing on their agenda. They can do it because of the huge financial savings.
But the thing about it is, they need to do this to save America. Generation after generation of children growing up in these situations have destroyed many of the children's potential, many of the family's potential, and many of the United States' potential. I think it's important that I give out your website. Please, if you really want to get involved and understand these situations, go to www.battered.org. BarryGoldstein.net. I encourage you to do this. Share it with your friends. Share it with your state representatives. And share it with your family.
I appreciate that. And, you know, we were talking yesterday about the Safe Child Act. And on the website, under important articles, is an article about the Safe Child Act, which is the comprehensive solution to the problems in the custody court. The Safe Child Act is the remedy in the Quincy solution to stop abusers from manipulating the court in order to regain control over their victims.
I think it's awesome that Hawaii has become the first state to introduce the Safe Child Act, and that the state's Child Act will help judges protect children by mandating the use of current scientific research, and like the ACE and the Sanders research. Could you share some of that, what they found out in the ACE and the Sanders?
Yes. The ACE study, ACE stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences, is really medical research. And it's from the Centers for Disease Control, so it's highly credible. And the bottom line is that children exposed to domestic violence, child abuse, and other traumas will live shorter lives and have more illness and injury throughout their lives. And, you know, one of the problems in the courts is that, you know, 30, 40 years ago when we had no research, the courts turned to mental health professionals as if they were the experts in domestic violence. And they do have something to contribute. They're the experts in psychology, in mental illness. They're not the experts in domestic violence. And so right now what the courts want them to do is essentially see how are the children doing. But the problem is the children react in a lot of different ways to exposure to domestic violence and other traumas, and lots of times on the surface they seem to be doing well, but underneath they're having some real problems. And what the ACE study shows is that over their lifetime they're going to have more health and other problems unless we do something about it. And so the ACE study gives us an enormous opportunity. You know, Lisa, if you think about our present level of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, suicide, crime, dropping out of school, all sorts of horrible things, is based on our long tolerance for what we now call domestic violence and child abuse.
And could you repeat that again? Because that is so important for people to understand. And that one paragraph just blew me away when I read it.
Yeah, I mean, what we're saying is that the present levels of diseases like mental illness, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, social problems like suicide and crime and dropping out of school, all of these problems are based on our present, well, let me say this, from our long history of tolerating domestic violence and child abuse. So that if we can use the best practices to reduce domestic violence and child abuse, all these horrible diseases and social problems will be significantly reduced, which is just an incredible benefit to society.
And
the other side of it is there will be a huge financial savings when we're not spending all that money on health care and people unable to reach their economic potential, so we can be a healthier, a happier, and a wealthier community when we adopt the Quincy solution.
And it's important that people understand that stress creates inflammation, and inflammation creates a lot of these diseases, and that's how they came up with that. I also think something that you pointed out to me, which I really never even thought of, I don't know why, and this is like so simple to understand, when you really think about it. The public understands that we need different doctors for different problems because doctors specialize in different diseases. But yet, in the court system, people don't understand that you need a different mental health professional to help a family that's been going through domestic violence. It's so different than just child abuse or substance abuse. It is wholly different. And the common use of mental health and other professionals without expertise in domestic violence have created a staggering amount of children that have walked through the court system from their families straight into the prison system and full of all types of problems because of all the stress and all the animosity that domestic violence creates.
Yes, you know, when I was researching my Quincy book, I had a chance to interview doctors and other medical professionals who are working with the ACE research. And I asked them the question that really ought to be the most important question for court administrators and judges hearing these cases. And that is, when a child has been exposed to domestic violence, child abuse, other ACEs, is there anything we can do now to save the child from these horrific consequences? And the answer was probably yes. But there are two things we need to put in place. The first is that the children are going to need therapy and medical treatment. They'll need therapy both to deal with whatever specific problems they have and also to relieve stress. And they will need medical treatment, again, to relieve specific problems. And, you know, maybe they have a sleeping problem, maybe they have an eating problem, a stomach problem. And they need it, again, to relieve stress. And, you know, doctors can decide how to do that. It might be as simple as exercise or meditation or yoga, or it might be anti-anxiety medication, but we got to relieve that stress. And what that means for the custody courts is that the safe parent has to have total control over medical decisions because the abuser is going to undermine this treatment because he's going to believe that he didn't cause any harm. The second thing we need to put in place, the children can't be exposed to more abuse. And there's a fundamental, I think, misunderstanding about the cause of domestic violence. You know, it's not the man responding to something his partner did. It's not a relationship problem. It's nothing about her. He has a belief that he's entitled to control the relationship and to make the decisions in the relationship, and so he's entitled to use whatever tactics he needs to coerce her to do what he wants. What that means is that the end of the relationship doesn't end his abusiveness, it doesn't change him, so that even if he stops abusing the mother, and we know very often in these custody cases, the lawsuit is designed to hurt the mother, he's going to abuse future partners. And that means children are going to be exposed to further abuse. What this means is that if we're going to save the children from the consequences, we have to force him to change and to stop his abuse. Otherwise, he's going to do more harm to the child than good. And right now, what the custody courts are doing is they're pressuring the victims to accommodate the abuser instead of pressuring the abuser to stop the abuse if he wants a relationship with the children.
It's very sad. Barry's books actually provide a comprehensive evidence-based guidance research, and it's they're a must for local libraries, domestic violence shelters, court personnels. Barry, could you talk about your four different books real quickly? You have actually four that you have worked with.
Well, there's five.
Five.
Although two are, you know, the same book, but a different first and second volume. I co-edited with Dr. Mo Therese Hanna, who's a leading psychologist in terms of domestic violence and who who founded the Battered Mothers Custody Conference. And we co-edited two books called Domestic Violence Abuse in Child Custody. And what we did with the first book is we brought together the leading experts in the U.S. and Canada, and they included judges and lawyers and psychologists and psychiatrists and sociologists and journalists and DV advocates, so that we could approach the issue from all the different sides. And what we did was we put all of the research together in one book so that we could better respond. The second book has more of that, but it also has new research. So my Quincy book started as a chapter in that book. We also have a chapter by Camille Cooper who explains why a quarter of the children in the U.S. Are sexually abused by the time they're 18, and a chapter by Diane Bartlow that followed up on 175 children murdered by fathers involved in custody court litigation in a two-year period. And we wanted to ask the judges in the communities, what have they done in response to the tragedy to reform the system? And I think people will be surprised at the answer. I have another book co-written with Elizabeth Liu, representing the domestic violence survivor, which is designed to train attorneys to present DV cases, because as you know, it's very difficult to find an attorney who understands domestic violence and who's willing to really advocate for the mothers and the children. Those three books are really, they're like textbooks. Anything we say, you have to have, you know, strong citations from scientific research to support. My first book was a book called Scared to Leave, Afraid to Stay, which told the stories of 10 mothers going through the system trying to get away from their abuser. And, you know, the idea was to show, you know, what needs to be done and the difficulties. And the last book is what you talked about before, the Quincy Solution, Stop Domestic Violence and Save $500 Billion, which I think is really exciting because we can really change society in some wonderful ways.
Once again, Barry can be reached by going to www.barrygoldstein.net. And also, I would love you to touch on the Battered Women's Custody Conference and your Lifetime Achievement Award.
Okay. The Battered Women's Custody Conference came about started in 2004. This will be the 12th annual conference. And it's really wonderful. It brings together protective mothers and professionals who are helping them. And it has grown each year to, you know, much more of a movement. And, you know, one of the things I find interesting, the mothers get a chance to speak to each other, and they find out that other mothers are in the same situations, and those mothers are easy to admire. And it really says something because they've spent all this time being attacked and ridiculed by their abuser, and too often by the courts. So it's good to hear. And usually at some point someone says, you know, we must have been married to the same man. Because it's the same tactics. And the courts are looking at each case and each incident separately, and so they're missing the pattern. So the Battered Mothers Conference is going to be held again this year in Albany, May 6th to 8th. Which is a Friday to a Sunday, and if anyone is close enough to the area that they can come, it is a wonderful weekend. Some of the leading experts are there to speak and to provide information and ideas for how to deal with the crisis, and I'm very pleased. What happened last year, Mo Hanna arranged so that I received the a Lifetime Achievement Award. But what was really special is that she invited mothers, and in one case a child, up to the podium to talk about how I had helped them. And it was a very emotional outpouring, and something I'll always remember.
And, you know, Barry, they'll always remember you for your grace and your wisdom and your kindness and all that you do. Our time is up, and I encourage everybody that is interested to please go to kkfi.org or www.barrygoldstein.net. The best interest of our children have become a justification for violations of basic civil rights, civil liberties, and due process of law. Thank you for listening to Jaws of Justice. Up next is the calendar of events.
Now, the calendar of events for March 21st, 2016. The Kansas City chapter of Missouri Cure will meet tonight, Monday, March 21st, at 6 p.m. at the Bluford Library, 31st and Prospect Avenue, KCMO. Missouri Citizens United for Reform of Errants works to ensure proper health care, food, and humane and respectful treatment of the incarcerated and their families. There will be a construction career fair Saturday, April 2nd at the Robert J. Mohart Center, 3200 Wayne Avenue, KCMO. Registration begins at 8:30 a.m. and the fair runs from 9 to 11:30 a.m. You must be 18 years of age or older to participate. There will be representatives from over 20 craft union apprenticeship programs available. A severe shortage of trained workers is expected in the Kansas City area later this year. Take this opportunity to get not just a job, but a career. For more information, contact Frida Jenkins at 816-471-2330, extension 1290, or email fjenkins@fecc.org, or call Tony Jones at 816-471-2330, extension 1206, or email him at ajones@fecc.org. If you are concerned about getting body cams on our police, racial profiling by the police, making police get written consent to search your car, and being able to track complaints against police officers when they move from one department to another, there is something you can do. Contact Representative Sean Rhodes, the chair of the Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness Committee of the Missouri House, and urge him to allow House Bills 1516, 1520, 1521, and 1522 to have hearings and votes in the committee. You can contact his office at 573-751-1455 or by email at Sean@house.mo.gov. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. That's kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Tune in next week when host Nancy Leeser talks with Christy Childs of Veronica's Voice about their efforts to help prostitutes get out of the life and their new residential facility. Then, host Keith Brownell talks with Jamala Rogers about her upcoming event in KC on her book, Ferguson is America, Roots of Rebellion. Welcome back to Jaws of Justice Radio. This is Jeff Humfeld, and unfortunately, our a scheduled host, Rebecca Brock, was not able to make it today. She had some pressing legal things in court to handle. She is a lawyer, and sometimes those things happen. Today, we want to talk a little bit about, Senate Bill 572. And this is something that came about in the wake of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson and the demonstrations and all the things that happened after that. The Justice Department came in and made some recommendations, did some investigation, and then the Missouri Supreme Court also made some recommendations. One of them had to do with subject of the court are using tickets and the like to create revenue to run the government, and that's something that just isn't working out well. Our guest today is Judge Artie Bland from the Kansas City Municipal Court. Welcome, Judge.
Good morning. Good morning. Happy to be here.
You and I, it looks like everybody else on the court have signed on to a letter, and then you and a few others went down and testified about this Senate Bill 572, which, you know, was put together to address this whole issue of unfair fines and putting people in jail for failure to pay fines or inability to pay the fines. And you testified against this bill. And I guess we want to talk a little bit about why today. But before we do that, before we get into the bill itself, why don't you tell us a little bit about what kind of things the municipal court deals with? You know, are we talking housing codes? Are we talking public drunkenness or traffic violations? You know, what all does the municipal court actually deal with?
Well, it's interesting. Kansas City, Missouri is a little bit different probably from any other city in the state of Missouri in that we're the largest court. We have 8 full-time judges, 1 part-time, but you might as well say full-time housing court judge because he's so involved in many projects. And we deal with a lot of the things that you just said, housing code violations. We deal with traffic. But because of the nature of the way Kansas City is made, Kansas City spreads across 4 counties, Cass, Clay, Platte, and Jackson, with the lion's share of the city being Jackson County. Well, Jackson County is so overloaded with so many cases of a violent nature that many of those offenses fall to the city. So we do assaults, we do stealing, we do domestic violence cases, approximately 4,000 of those a year. We do, you know, your public intox, we do DUIs, we do, you know, down to no insurance, speeding, and then, you know, other violations along zoning and housing ordinance, you know, animal control, those types of things. So we do a wide variety of cases, but a lot more violent offenses probably than any other city because of the nature of the way our city is made.
Well, let's get down to Senate Bill 572 then.
Okay.
And what this bill is, like I said, it was written to address this whole thing of unjust revenue generating through municipal courts. This is a practice that was very prevalent in Ferguson and St. Louis County courts. And I think we were talking beforehand, probably some smaller courts around the state that, you know, the communities don't have a whole lot of other revenue coming in. And this is something that was against the rules in the first place, is it not?
Much of what was there was against the rules. And a lot of the rules that were made really as a result of the Ferguson issue, and I believe you brought that out earlier. Some of the courts, it's safe to say, based upon the working group set up by the Supreme Court, weren't following rules. And that's kind of how we got here. You have to kind of understand how it works, though. Some of the smaller places, as I'm understanding the research, were actually using their tickets to increase revenues. And there was a law that said that your revenue could only be a certain amount to be within legal realms. And if that was the case, if your revenue from traffic cases was over a certain point, then that money should be turned over to the state. Well, my understanding of it is that cities were violating that rule, which I believe initially started out at about 30%. They were violating that rule, but then there was no accounting being done for that money to then, in excess, to be turned over to the state. And I think that's really kind of how we got there, with an understanding that everyone should have, that essentially almost all of the revenue from the Kansas City Municipal Court from traffic still puts us about less than 3%. And so to show you the disparity or the difference between those particular cities, a city like Kansas City in its size is less than 3% from its traffic revenues, but then from other cities, their traffic revenues were over 30%. So they were essentially making money by giving folks traffic tickets.
So in effect, what they were doing was the money over the 30% or whatever that limit was that should have been going to the state, they were keeping that money.
It sounds like they were lining their coffers.
I'm sure that the state of Missouri didn't appreciate that, especially our legislature.
Not at all.
All right, you've explained what some of these practices are. We have a number of different entities that are trying to address this issue. The U.S. Justice Department, of course, came in and looked around and made recommendations and maybe even something stronger than a recommendation, you know, an order. There's basically two groups within the state that can address and should address these issues. One is the courts themselves. And I think a lot of people don't understand that the Missouri Supreme Court is over all of the courts the state of Missouri.
That's correct.
So they have rules that they make and practices that they recommend or that they say this is the way you should conduct yourself and the like. And then the legislature also has a role here too. So can you kind of explain some of the differences between what the legislature could do and should do and what the Supreme Court would do in cases like this?
Well, I'll start with the Supreme Court because that may be the easiest. And essentially, the Supreme Court lays out rules. And for municipal courts, it's Missouri Rule 37, which basically sort of lays out all of the procedures that municipal courts must follow in the state of Missouri. And so we basically find out, you know, what we're supposed to do with our bonds, due process, everything else from the Supreme Court rules. The legislature, though, passes rules that say things like no fines can be over a certain amount, which is essentially the major rule, or other rules which would say that for a particular crime in the state, a person cannot serve more than so many days.
Exactly.
And so that's essentially what they do. And in many ways, then, what each municipality or city or city council does, they try to pass laws within line what the legislature says for the state. And so I think in some ways there's almost three sets of rules that you sort of have to keep in mind.
Okay, we're going to get down into some of the minutia here, so to say.
Sure.
But we want people to understand this issue and all, because it's real easy to look at our municipal court and say, why the heck are you against this? And they need to understand the things. One of the practices was this dismissal upon payment of cost, dismissal of charges if you pay the fine or you pay, you know, court costs or something like this. And if you're charged with something, that's not the way that it's supposed to be done. In other words, the Supreme Court's rules on municipal courts say, no, if you charge them, you have to go through with this trial. They can't buy their way out of having done something wrong, basically. Is that assertion?
Well, I think a better way of looking at it is if you go into court and they can't make the case against you, and that case is dismissed, they don't have the right to charge you cost on the case. and that's by rule. And so one of the sets of rules that we just talked about a moment ago, and what we find happening from the research that was done by the operating groups and I believe the Justice Department, is that a number of cities had been dismissing cases upon payment of costs, which is something that was not the rule, which I think is one of the things that kind of got the ire of the legislature.
Part of that is why are cases sometimes waived or those costs that the state would normally pay, you know, the state or the county or the municipality would say, all right, we have our courts open, we're paying to have them open, and this case has been dismissed and moved on. Why is it that sometimes a case comes in and they just waive it?
Well, a number of things happen. For example, being in a city where we have, at our level, a number of violent offenses, oftentimes many people don't want to come in and testify, either out of fear or the difficulty of for that person to take off from work, or, you know, just a number of reasons that just happen. Or the city may even look at the case and say, hey, this is a case we can't prosecute. We can't. The evidence wasn't there. Maybe it was an improper charge. Sometimes the charge may have been written wrong, or there's some evidence that they couldn't produce to be able to sustain the charge, and in which case then the case is dismissed.
I want to give you an opportunity here to explain in your own words what the real objections are to the way this bill is written and what court would like to see changed. In the letter that you wrote, you mentioned public safety and is at risk in Kansas City. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, one of the reasons why I have objected to Senate Bill 572 in private and publicly is that I believe that it places the entire community at a large safety risk. And many people are saying that this is about revenue, and it's really not a revenue issue for the city of Kansas City, except for in a small way. And I'll explain that in a moment. But essentially what Senate Bill 572 does is it makes certain charges, if not all charges within the city of Kansas City, where you can't charge a fine of more than $200, which is kind of the main thing, but it also takes away, along with the Senate Bill 5 from last year, it takes away any jail time possibility for a number of charges. And so one of the main things that does is, for a city the size of Kansas City and with the Truce Corridor problem that's been talked about so frequently here, it creates a potential blight issue in one instance. It also presents an insurance issue in another instance. And so essentially what happens is, if you live in a community here and someone basically wants to raise a junkyard next to your home, which everyone knows then would decrease your property values, then the worst thing that the city would be able to do would be to charge that person $200. Well, and what we found, though, through history, is that once communities become blighted, crime increases. And I think over time, that's one of the problems, because if you have properties that are owned by people that are trashing it or setting up junkyards, and you can't arrest them, you can't give them jail time, and the only thing you can do is give them a $200 fine, they become scofflaws and they have no reason to do anything. And so the neighborhood starts to deteriorate. People who were good neighbors then desire to move out, if possible, by selling the properties. And that's one concern that we have from the housing side of it. Another concern that we have is that this particular law now allows people to not have insurance, to speed up to 19 miles per hour, to run stop signs, anything else they want to, with impunity. There's nothing really to stop them. Even if the police officer stops them and they don't have insurance and they're speeding and it's below 19 miles per hour and an accident was not involved, They can take the ticket, tear it up in front of the officer, drop it on the ground. He could charge them with littering, and they could pick it up and do it again, and there's nothing, and he couldn't take them in. And I think what happens is, it's, you know, this is the example that I used when talking to representatives of the House. Safety starts before an accident happens. And so Kansas City created and developed a program long time ago for rehabilitation and compliance. And so we're really big on probation, where we supervise and make sure people have their insurance. And we do programs like Veterans Treatment Court, where we bring in the vets and we help them get back on their feet, get their driver's licenses, get homes. We have a truancy court, which doesn't fine people, but helps to solve the problems for families so that the kids can get back in school and they can get the education that they need. We have mental health court. We have drug court. All of these programs are set up to try to rehabilitate our community. But when we have laws that are passed that allow people to say, hey, I can do whatever I want to do, and there's nothing you can do to me, you can't really have probationary programs which help to rehabilitate your community and help to get people back on their feet.
To put them on probation, they have to be sentenced, right?
And if we can't sentence them for anything because we can't make them come to court, and even if they come to court, the only thing we could do is give them a $200 fine, then they just keep doing whatever they want to do. And I think nobody has a problem with the guy the first time that they get a no insurance ticket and speeding, or the second time, or maybe even the fifth time, but on the 11th or 12th time that they get one, but that time they ran into a family and injured a small child for a family who can't afford the medical bills, then all of a sudden it's a big deal. And I think that's where, you know, it presents a safety problem. And I mean, I know for a fact that we have 20,000 people that we've caught in Kansas City that are driving around without insurance. That is a sheer danger to the community. And it's unfair to those of us who are paying our insurance every month to keep our family and our city safe.
Wow, that's a lot to think about. And once again, the issues of how you address that. So I guess any set of rules can be manipulated, so to say, and there's people that will learn to do that. You know, I know in my own neighborhood, the littering is pretty bad, the dumping. There's a stretch along 29th Street. You know, there's no houses on the street. It's almost like a country road, and there's a lot of that. Trying to catch those people is one thing, but doing something to them once you catch them is a whole different thing again.
And I think that's the problem with Senate Bill 572 is, if that passes, there's essentially almost nothing you can do to those folks.
All right. What kind of fix would you put in, would you suggest, for this bill? You know, how could they change it or amend it? Or is it, we got to go back to the drawing board and start over on this?
I'll really be honest with you. I think in retrospect, I think if they were to just leave Senate Bill 5 in place, give it some time to kind of play out and see how it goes, I think they would be fine. I think Senate Bill 572, and I talked with you about this earlier, I think it just reaches too far. And I think that's part of the problem, in that it makes everything essentially that our court does a municipal ordinance violation, which then has a $200 fine attached to it maximum. And I think if they were to leave it alone, continue to use discretion, one of the things that I find interesting about them creating Senate Bill 572 was there was some testimony which indicated that a lady was being unfairly prosecuted because of her blinds and some other things that were actually in her house that was an issue. But there was testimony again at the last hearing that I went to that essentially said that she lied about everything to get this bill past the Senate. And I think that's what happens, is we take an overreaction to something that we've not fully researched to find out, okay, well, is this really what happened? Is there something wrong with the system that we set up? I think specifically what would be best for the entire state is if they were to carve out, or definitely for Kansas City, to carve out an exception for Kansas City. Kansas City already has an exception by state law because of the class and charter size that, or class size and the charter city that we have. But I would even say if you have cities that have general, revenue, its courts revenue is very minimal, but then they're putting more money back into programs, which is essentially what Kansas City does. If you're following these sets of rules or these guidelines, then you're exempted from certain rules because essentially operating at about 3% revenue, Kansas City has been providing all of these programs. Many of these other cities have a significant more amount of their revenue from traffic, but there's no programs. And so one of the things that even that we do is our particular court functions at a loss. And in many ways, we do more programs with our money that comes in from the revenue to help the city more than anything else.
Unfortunately, our time is up.
Okay.
And we have to move on. Coming up will be the 420 Drug War News. But Judge Bland, we very much appreciate your coming in, and we're going to have you come in and talk about the two courts that you're over, the mental health court or the veterans court. So thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Last week, the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University sponsored a panel, Law Enforcement Perspectives on Drug Prohibition. The panelists included the District Attorney of Houston, Harris County, Devin Anderson, and a 30-year veteran of the Drug Enforcement Administration, Mr. Gary Hale.
Most laws are the reflection or the reaction of a public need or will. Most, but not all, drug laws have their genesis at the federal level and form the basis for state drug laws. There are exceptions where local and state drug issues cause the federal government to react and create or change laws. A case in point was the methamphetamine was a big problem in the United States in the 1980s. People were making methamphetamine in their garages, in hotel rooms, and just about any small space. And they were taking ephedrine, Sudafed, and all kinds of ephedrine products to convert to methamphetamine. So that was a local problem that rose up to the federal level. DEA made recommendations to Congress. Laws were changed, and some controls were placed on ephedrine such that now you have to go identify yourself. It's no longer over-the-counter. You have to go and present your driver's license to get certain quantities of ephedrine. So I believe that the framework for current drug policy at the federal level is generally sound. That is, to balance or to attempt to balance equal effort on the supply side and the demand side. Remember, that's the general outlook or basis by which the federal government works. So as a framework, it is a sound approach to looking at the overall problem. Are we going to put resources, money, manpower, agents, whatever they may be, U.S. government resources on the supply side, or are we going to put them on the demand side? And I've noticed that those two usually are applied by political parties. The tendency is for Democrats to favor the demand side and the Republicans to favor the supply side. That's just a tendency, not a fact. So the question is, has the drug war failed? Instead of saying, has the drug war failed, I'll say that the federal government at large, is just a personal opinion, is doing poorly. I'll give it a D, okay, let's call it a deficient, instead of an F or a failure.
Once again, that was Gary Hale, a former special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration, giving a D to the drug war. This is Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale.